From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 1 year ago when student loan debt nationwide crossed the $1.3 trillion mark. More than 2 million student loan borrowers have loan debt greater than $100,000. Nearly 500,000 former students have debt surpassing $200,000. And time after time, borrowers say that they didn't really have a lot of perspective on how great the debt would be or what it would take to pay it off. 1 hour from now, Governor Andrew Cuomo will deliver his annual State of the State address. The governor will roll out a new four-point plan to address student loan debt. He's going to be talking about predatory lending, financial literacy, and more. Is it enough? What can be done to make sure students don't feel forced to change careers just to pay off going to college in the first place? My guests this hour in studio include Chuck Wade, Vice President and Financial Advisor of Brighton Securities. Chuck, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also here is Bianca Bishop, a healthcare integrator at Hillside Family of Agencies. Bianca, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Shadi Coffey is an attorney, a former teacher and administrator, and an aspiring author. Shadi, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And it's Shadi, Chuck, Bianca, all have their own stories on loan debt. And what I want to do is kind of just work through some of their own experiences, because I think with our listeners, they're going to ring true with a lot of people. And listeners, if you want to call the program this hour, you can do that. It's toll free. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Chuck, loan debt still?
Yes, I just refinanced, actually, three or four months ago. Not a huge amount left, but was able to, just by refinancing it, knock off a couple of years worth of payments and several thousand dollars, and was happy about that. But
was the 19-year-old Chuck Wade assuming you'd be sitting here still paying off loan debt?
I had no idea. You know, the first time I remember experiencing any real or learning about student loans was when I had graduated from college, and you and I worked together in a different life when we were at Channel 13. And you know, my first job, I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I started getting paychecks and realized, oh, I don't make a lot of money. And I'm going to go on this income-based repayment plan because I don't make a lot enough to try to pay what I'm paying right now.
Right.
And then I got into understanding for the first time, oh, yeah, I got to pay this money. And then it leaves the bank and it's gone. And you're going to do it for a long time.
A long time. Yeah. Especially given the broadcasting, the impecunious life of the college the post-college broadcasters, you were looking at maybe decades.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's been over 10 years and still knocking it off. So, yeah.
All right. Well, Shadi, you are someone who went to, let's see here, undergrad at the University of St. Thomas, is that right?
Yes.
In Houston?
Yes.
And then law school at Thurgood Marshall School of Law, also in Houston.
Yes.
What did you know about loan debt going into those enterprises?
Absolutely nothing in the beginning as far as the long-term consequences. I was living in the moment very much so and thinking, here I am getting a full scholarship to St. Thomas, so it makes sense to take out a loan for my dorm expenses and my living expenses. So it felt like a give and take, not really looking at the long term, but making college work in the moment.
Okay, and what about law school?
It was the same concept in law school, really not looking at what those monthly premiums were going to look like, what type of income I was going to have coming in. It was presumed that with a law degree, you're going to come out and make big bucks, not really understanding that that's not always the case with attorneys, and not really having the financial literacy to say, okay, this is what's going to be coming in. This is what the expenses are going to be. Life happens, which did in my case, which could be put you behind even more. And how am I really going to make this work?
So you were in that position of, you know, at St. Thomas saying, well, I got a scholarship, but I can take out loans for other things. Why not? I'll be making money after college.
Right.
Sort of abstractly, right?
And thinking that I was getting something in return with this great college education. Hey, they're paying me a full tuition scholarship for this private Catholic university. I can do my part and take out a little bit for living expenses. So I came out of there with you know, $12,000 loan, 4 year college. Otherwise, my parents would not have been able to afford college for me at all. So it was important. I needed to take that money out. Living at home was not an option for me.
Sure.
I needed to be off campus. So it made sense.
And now you look back, when's the first time you really kind of realized, whoa, this is a lot more than I realized I was taking on?
Well, when I graduated from law school, I think it's really important for people going to college to really understand what the day-to-day life of their profession is going to look like and what realistically their income is going to be, and not just an idea of what it is. Going into law, I was very passionate about social justice. So there was this idea of, you know, civil rights law, going out there, making a difference in the world, not really understanding what day-to-day is like. And what the practicalities of practicing law are like. So I think having that realistic view, for me, life happened. I had an illness. I ended up in the hospital, so I had huge medical expenses to pay, which I was lucky to have that all discharged. But that put me behind in being able to pay student loan debt. Mm-hmm. So having a financial counselor or someone really sit down with you, having financial literacy classes and saying, this is what you're going to get as your income. These are what your expenses are. Let's take into account emergencies, life happening. Let's take into account you're going to need long-term retirement money. This is life and you're going to retire one day. And what, you know, how do you save for that? So I think when I got sick is when I realized, oh, wow, I also have this debt.
Yeah. And this is probably what drives people like Chuck Wade nuts, because Chuck is a vice president and financial advisor with Brighton Securities. And that conversation Chadi's describing is after all of the debt is incurred. It's got to be before, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the hard part about all this is the most valuable years of any saver's life are the earlier ones. So for any, it'd be when you're just out of college and starting to work, because you've got so much time left for any investment to grow and compound over itself, which, but the problem is, if you've got $500, $600, $700, $800 a month that's just going out and you're starting in an entry-level job, it doesn't matter what field it is for the most part, a lot of folks are prevented from saving or putting money aside to buy a home, a lot of those variables, because they have such a large expense due to the student loans that they've incurred over the previous 4 years.
You switched careers, Shai?
I did. I had to at one point. Luckily, it was a career that I was passionate about, working with kids. So starting out in law for 5 years, transitioning to education was something very organic for me. But student loan debt was very much a factor there, because the government said, hey, you work for these Title I charter schools for 10 years, we'll forgive your debt. So that's a huge incentive for me. And even though I've left education for the past 4 months now, and I'm trying to rebuild my law practice again, I often think, and that's a heavy weight in my head, that, hey, I could get this debt discharged if I go back and put in another X amount of years in charter schools. But there are a lot of missing gaps in charter schools I'm not happy with, and I have a lot of strong opinions about that, and that's not necessarily the right fit for who I am as a person. It's a part of me, but there's just other things I want to do.
Yeah, so you feel that push-pull. You wanted to do kind of legal work, maybe in the social justice realm, didn't feel like you were paying the bills, and even with the best option financially, it doesn't feel like it's a perfect fit with you.
No, exactly.
So it's a lot of compromise. Now, Bianca Bishop is a healthcare integrator at Hillside Family of Agencies, and why don't you take us back to your undergrad and what you knew kind of going in, Bianca?
I started off going to Roberts Westland, which is a private school, so it's a lot of money to go there. And I knew that I was going to have a lot of loans coming out of college. I did not realize how much the payments were going to be even to start off. I just finished my master's degree in May, so my loans have just started to get into the repayment period, and my first payment was more than my rent. So I didn't realize how high it was going to be initially until I, you know, was going through the paperwork months after I graduated. And I tried to get into the low-income-based payment plans, and they've been processing it for months now. I've called them before. I was like, hi, I applied for this. Are you anywhere in the process of approving or denying it? I would just like to know. And they were like, oh, we're still going through it. So even though I've applied for, you know, the modification on that, I'm still paying these astronomical fees.
Was there a moment of shock when it all sort of finally settled in at one point for you?
Definitely there was. It was very emotional because I'm a social worker, so we don't make a lot of money in really any job that you do for social work. And like Shadi, I'm very into social justice, and I'm working with children right now, and I love it. But it's just so hard to maintain any sort of lifestyle. I have to, you know, pay my rent, pay my student loans. If you have a car payment or any sort of credit card payment or anything extra, you don't have much left at the end of the month or after any paycheck, really. And I'm paying, or my income right now is a lot higher than most of my social work colleagues, and it's not that high compared to really a lot of other careers, but you have to have a master's degree to get a good social work job and one that you would actually want to do. So it just kind of feels like, you know, I did all this education and I'm doing the job I want, but there's really no payout. You're just still struggling. And that doesn't feel good when you're, you know, finishing the career in the school you wanted to do.
And are you thinking about other lines of work, that kind of a decision?
I have thought about it because even though I love what I'm doing, it's just, it feels very hard to stick with it. So I have looked into maybe branching off into other things, but the other part of it is I've been working so long to get into social work, I don't have a lot of qualifications for other things. I've been doing, you know, social work interns since I was an undergrad, and I even worked at a social agency as an administrator before that. So my resume is all social work. So people aren't going to hire me in another field right now because I don't have a lot of qualifications otherwise.
All right. I see our phone's ringing. And in a moment, I'm going to go to some of your phone calls. But I also want to let you know what we're going to do this hour. I think these stories probably are familiar to so many listeners, whether it's yourself or family members, friends still paying off loans. Again, more than $1.3 trillion in student loan debt in this country. And next hour, Governor Cuomo in the State of the State is going to put forward a plan that he says should help. So in a moment, we're going to walk through what those four prongs are and see what our guests think. But I want to also ask them for their own ideas, if they were in the governor's ear, about one thing that maybe would make it easier or at least would help in this realm. So let's get to that in a minute. But first, I'm going to take a phone call from San Francisco. David in San Francisco. What are you doing in San Francisco, David?
Well, we're might cold here. It must be all of 57 degrees, and we're not sure what happens
so,
when it gets colder than this.
So sorry.
It's almost as cold as the summer.
Go ahead, sir.
You know, I back in the 1980s, I took financial management, and if you're familiar with that course, it's for chief financial officers of corporations. And we were instructed never borrow money over 3%. Never, ever, under any circumstances. Now, if you were to imagine that the universities, colleges, and you know these fly-by-night online colleges are causing the students to borrow money not only over 3%, but at 12% or 15% or whatnot, they know that it's a trap. And it becomes a fraud. Now, if their educational services in the financial the financial fields are teaching the students to never borrow over 3%, why would they force their incoming students to borrow it higher? So I consider it fraud. And I have wondered for 20 years why these online academies aren't considered organized crime.
Hmm. Well, David, hang there for 1 second. You got a little bit of a laugh out of Chuck Wade from Brighton Securities. First of all, do you think there's something fraudulent there or at least on the edge there, Chuck?
I'm not going to say fraud. I mean, I think that a lot of places that present themselves as a not-for-profit are not necessarily operating as a not-for-profit should, as a lot of colleges and universities do. David brought up a couple of good points and just some interesting numbers that I found as I was looking into this. So there's two kinds of loans you can get. You can get the federal loans or a private student loan. The average private loan right now has a variable interest rate of 7.8%. Variable meaning it can go up or can go down. It's calculated every so often against a certain benchmark. Mm-hmm. The average fixed rate on a private loan, 9.7%. This is from CNBC, you know, within the last couple of months. Now, the federal loan, which is where a lot of people start off, the Stafford loan is something that's very familiar, was just increased from 3.76% to call it 4.5%. To compare the 30-year mortgage, you can go buy a house right now, and if you've got decent credit, get a 30-year mortgage at anywhere from 4 to 4.25%. So they are very high interest rates. You know, I don't think there's any one person in general or group to blame, but there's a lot of different groups that are making it harder for people to take out loans continue to pay them and go forward in life.
David, what do you want to do about it?
Well, first of all, remember that interest rates are eternal, so to speak. 3% is always 3%. 4% is always 4%. And if you just did some basic research, back in the World War II and Korean War veterans were given 1.5% VA notes for buying a house. 1.5%. I think the baby boom was tricked by thinking that interest rates are something that should go up just like inflation. And that's not true. Interest rates are eternal. You know, it's a law of physics that a percentage is a percentage. And the idea that we've been tricked into believing that interest rates should go up, interest rates reflect our risk. And if we're dumb enough to accept an interest rate over 3%, then, you know, obviously the greed heads are going to try to trick us into 5%. You know, when your guest there mentioned 7% and then 9%, those are dangerous numbers. 3% was considered a dangerous number. 5% is considered fatal. 10% is mass murder. this is why we've got homelessness. This is why why we've got so much unemployment. This is why money is being sucked into the Cayman Islands. These are organized crime numbers. And in fact, just do a study of what were called usury laws.
Sure,
when Jimmy Carter was in office, the usury laws were not enforced. I was from Missouri, where the usury laws were set at 7%. And you know, organized crime was lending you money at over 7%. But when a lot of people think that the Iranian hostages were the reason Jimmy Carter was thrown out of office, but in fact it was interest rates had gone from basically 3% and 4% to 22%, and not one of the 50 states were enforcing the usury laws that they had on the books.
All right, so David, let me just jump in. First of all, I'll say thanks for the phone call. I only laughed because the analogy was a little flippant, but I understand the point you're making, that this is very, very serious and it's impacting millions of Americans. Here's Joe, Professor Joe Henderson on Twitter saying, high student loan debt is a great example of, he says, neoliberalism in education. He says, we currently have a society that downshifts financial risk and responsibility to the individual and away from any kind of investment in a larger social good. Other countries don't do this. So that's Joe on Twitter echoing some of the point that David is making there. So let's talk about what we can do. By the way, on the interest rates, Shani?
I can say that from deferring my student loans and over time, I've built at least minimum $15,000, $20,000 in interest accruing on my student loans.
Would you have ever believed that you could pay that much in interest way back before you started paying?
I had no knowledge of the concept of a numerical figure attached to that interest rate. The education was just simply not there. And I feel for students today that go to college not having this information that I wish I had.
Bianca?
I'm in the same boat as Shadi. I believe that when I first started college, my interest rate was, I believe, the 7.4%. And at that point, I didn't have any knowledge about what interest was. I didn't get my first credit card until like my very early 20s. And that's when I started to realize what interest was. And so then I realized, and that's going on my student loans. So it wasn't until I, was like making my credit card payments and keeping that in control that I realized my loans were going to be out of control.
I think a lot of students, and I probably when I was in college was the same way. 3%, even 7%. That's 7 extra cents on a dollar. Yeah, that doesn't seem that big. It doesn't, and Chuck, you got to have a lot of education to make sure people understand what that means.
Yeah, I felt the same way. I mean, I think, all right, well, what's 7% on $100? It's $7, but interest isn't calculated like that. It's always being calculated. So it's not just a one and done, and that's what your interest is. And you asked, well, what do we do? And I'll just segue into that. I think you start... Everyone's kind of mentioned it, is there has to be some sort of financial literacy that is required either at the high school level or, like public speaking, which I know when I went to college was a requirement of all freshmen. And it could be fairly basic, but folks don't have that. Kids don't have that. There's requirements that you take all these various courses. There has got to be some form of financial literacy that is required that can teach, well, this is what interest is, and this is how it impacts you, and this is how you can combat that, and strategies you can take to learn how to be more financially independent when you leave here, because all of a sudden the clock just starts and then you got to pay the money back.
You know, it's interesting what Chuck is saying is more of a discretion. I think it sounds like what you're saying is that should be built in every school you go to. So some schools are doing that. So East Rochester is an example that does, I think it's Life 101 for seniors, something like that. Is that what it was? And built into that is how do interest rates work? What is financial literacy? Life skills. So you want to graduate at ER now and you do stuff like that. But that's not every school, and other districts do it differently. I'm with you there. Bianca, what do you want to see change here?
I think there definitely needs to be more education. I think at high school level would be best, so that you get that information before you go off to maybe your dream college that costs you $50,000 a year or more than that. And I think that kids really need to know how interest rate works and the difference between like federal loans and private loans, unsubsidized and subsidized loans, and what their options are going to be at the very end.
How about you get a loan, but you got to take a quiz, and if you can't pass the quiz on how your interest rate payments are going to work after you're out of school, you can't get the loan. That would be that'd be strong. But
I don't see any reason not to do. I don't see any reason not to do that.
Okay, Shawnee, what do you want to see?
I think we need to even the playing field here. I don't think that this information needs to be for CFOs and those who are just business savvy. I know my brother is incredibly financially literate. I don't know how he got that way. Something he did at very, very young age. I think that it's an even more heavy social responsibility here in Rochester, given the poverty level that we have here. I think, you know, having worked for three of the largest charter schools in the country that are working to close the achievement gap, getting student test scores and reading and math levels high, I have not seen, and I'm only speaking to this particular schools I've worked for, I have not seen financial literacy classes. We're teaching kids how to get to and through college and preparing them for college, but we're not talking to them about what their income is going to look like, how they're going to manage their debt. So I'd very much like to see that in the classroom at a young age in every school. And I think we can just create very practical examples that they can understand and make it relatable, and it's doable. Why aren't we doing it?
All right. So listeners, next hour, you're going to hear Governor Cuomo's State of the State address, and his office released in advance part of his plan for dealing with student loan debt. It's got four prongs. David in San Francisco, hope you're still listening on your WXXI mobile app, because some of what you talked about with what you thought was fraudulent or borderline criminal is addressed, or at least the governor will say it's addressed, and it's up to you to decide if you think it's addressed enough. So let's go over the points. We'll see what our guests think. Number one, appoint a student loan ombudsman. And the governor's office writes the following, quote, "The governor proposes creating a student loan ombudsman at the Department of Financial Services. The ombudsman will be the student borrower's advocate to help resolve student complaints, mediate disputes, and educate borrowers about student loans. The ombudsman will also offer free financial counseling and assistance for students in default. This will help ensure that New York student borrowers are protected regardless of any changes that are made to the federal ombudsman program with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau." End quote. Chuck, good enough?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it can hurt. I don't, it's, there's not one answer to this problem,
gotcha.
But I
yep.
think it's a good idea. And the thing that I like is that, so there almost becomes a mediator of sorts for if you've got a dispute right now, you have to go to the loan company. To your loan issuer and dispute it. Whereas if you have somebody that can act either on your behalf or as an independent third party on disputes, I really don't think that can hurt. You know, because right now it's you against the company, and you know, I don't think the odds there are that great in favor of the borrowers.
Okay, Bianca, how does that sound to you? The student loan ombudsman.
I think that is an important piece of the solution, not the entire solution, but I think that is a good start, especially the ombudsman advocating for the student and the borrower, because if, you know, we don't have the education ahead of time and we're coming into this trying to figure things out as we go, the financial institution is going to have so much more knowledge on our loans than we do, really. So having that ombudsman there would be a great help for the students and borrowers.
Okay. Shadi?
I think it'd be great as long as this person isn't someone that I'm just going to voice a complaint, but that that complaint is going to lead to an action. So if this person has some tools that they can give me where we can take it to the next level, I think that giving some practical advice about, for example, your student loans could have a cap. Like, it's not this infinity amount of money that you can get out. But based on your individual circumstances, maybe the profession you want to go into, maybe your life, you know, we are going to recommend that you don't take out $30,000, but you take out $6,000. And we're not going to let you take more than $6,000 out. Something, some very practical advice, something where my complaint can be turned into an action step. I think those need to be incorporated, and for this not to just be a pool of complaints and grievances that don't go anywhere.
Sure, and I think to backpack on Shadi's very good point there, the person's got to be accessible. There's a lot of people who are going to need help, and it's easy to say, ombudsman's for everyone, but got to be accessible. Number two, the governor says the following. Wants to require colleges to provide simple truth in lending facts for students. And quoting from the governor's office, quote, the governor proposes requiring all colleges annually provide students with the estimated amounts incurred for student loans, including the amount of student loans incurred to date, a range of the total payoff amount, including principal and interest, and the monthly repayment amount that the student may incur for the loan to date. This proposal expands on the governor's financial aid award information sheet, aiming to help inform students of the cost prior to going to college, end quote. Okay, so that is an annual update for students that gives you sort of a range of total payoff amount, and again, principal and interest, and what a monthly, this to me, Chuck, the one that really matters here is you would see a monthly repayment amount. So it's not just, hey, you've got $34,000 to pay. It says you're going to be paying $794 a month. Get ready. You know, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that should be made very clear and very simple. You see it on credit card statements a lot where it'll say, well, if you pay the minimum amount, you will pay this much and it'll take you this many years to pay it off. I think you need to see the same thing with student loans. This is something that should already be in place. And it is. You just got to dig through the 30 pages of disclosures that you sign when you're signing your loan documents. You know, I had friends that would in college that would use their loan checks just as spending money. And that's a big issue because now you're just adding on this debt. And you know, this might be something that hopefully or in an ideal world would stem some of that because you're seeing, all right, well, this is going to equate to me owing $750 a month for 15 years.
Yeah, that sound pretty familiar to you, Shadi? The idea of a loan check is sort of a spending check.
Yeah, when I went to law school, my parents couldn't afford law school for me. That was way beyond their means. I used that money to sustain my living expenses. I paid for books with that money. And I'm not going to lie, I had an extra refund check that not only me, my friends, we all look forward to our refund check because that was extra money we could do whatever we wanted with. But again, we did not pay attention to those monthly repayment amounts. And if I can comment on that portion of the governor's proposal, I think that a part of that is starting early. I think starting your first year in college with that education, your college education is great, but I would say let's do it in high school.
Okay, part three for the governor. He says the following. He wants to, and David in San Francisco, this is where your concerns come in about predatory lending. He says he wants to increase consumer protection standards throughout the student loan industry. Quoting from the governor's office, Governor Cuomo proposes sweeping protections for students, including ensuring that no student loan servicers or debt consultants can mislead a borrower or engage in any predatory act or practice, misapply payments, provide credit reporting agencies with inaccurate information, or any other practices that may harm the borrower. These protections will also include banning upfront fees, requiring fair contracts and clear and conspicuous disclosures to borrowers, and providing penalties for failing to comply with the law. Further, the proposal will require that these companies servicing student loans must be licensed and meet standards consistent with the laws and regulations governing other significant lending industries like mortgages. End quote. There's a lot of specifics there, but there's also some sort of vague stuff. And Chuck Wade, when he says, when the governor says that they cannot mislead a borrower or engage in any predatory act or practice, that's a sort of a broad sweep there?
It is. There was an article I was reading last night about a class action suit, or it may not be the class action level yet, but it was, like Shadi, you'd mentioned, there's several fields that if you go into them and you work for 10 years, they'll forgive or discharge your loans. But the issue is, when does the clock start on that 10-year period? Does it start when you signed into that program, if you'd been paying on your loans for a year and a half ahead of that? And, you know, it appears that there were people in this article I was reading that when they would talk to the student loan company and say, hey, am I good on this? Am I all set? And they were told, yes, you know, your loans will be forgiven after 10 years. And then they'd get to that period and learn that they had an extra year or another year and a half because of when they had entered that program or wrong information. So I think that, you know, you see this all the time in various industries where you speak to one person, you get one piece of information, and sometimes you speak to someone else and you get another, is that there needs to be a real lockdown on being able to give information that would be misleading or vague, because it can have real consequences for people.
Bianca, you want to see them go after people who are misleading?
Absolutely, I do.
I imagine you do. Yeah, it's a, I mean, look, I think if they're going to be specific, if they can lay out the specifics of what that means, that can be effective. Otherwise, that's sort of a, we don't put up with bad stuff kind of a thing that's probably going to be vague. But I don't know. We'll see. Point number four, because I know Shadi's got a jet in a second. And we're going to get back to some of your comments that have been coming in, listeners. But point number four that you're going to hear from the governor next hour in his State of the State. He wants to prohibit state agencies from suspending the professional licenses of individuals behind or in default of their student loans. Quoting from the governor's office, the governor will propose a law expressly prohibiting the suspension of professional licenses of individuals behind or in default on their student loans. Currently, there are 19 states that allow for the suspension of a professional license for people who are behind or in default on their student loans, with one state allowing for the suspension of an individual's driver's license. This practice severely limits the ability of people to support themselves and their families and to ultimately pay back their student loans, creating a further financial death spiral. By expressly prohibiting this practice, the governor will ensure that current and future New Yorkers are protected. End quote. That's the case, Chuck Wade. Those who are against this would say that's personal responsibility and there are consequences. But the governor is pointing to this, saying once that happens and you lose this job because of it, you're going to have a hard time getting another job. If you lose a driver's license, you can't get to work. Sure. It's a spiral. So
yeah, no, I completely understand that these companies, when you agree to something, they want to have some form of getting you to pay it back and being assured that you will. So whether that is there has to be some form of penalty for not holding up your obligation.
Okay.
But at the same time, if you're taking away someone's ability to work or operate in the field in which they are paid, how do you expect to have any shot of getting that money paid back? You know, I don't know what the penalty needs to be, but I think that in a lot of cases, it's somewhat redundant that you would take away someone's ability to earn when you're trying to collect a debt. That doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me.
And it's incredibly disheartening when the role that you're playing is one of social justice and you're actually trying to give back to society.
Sure.
You're trying to do something positive and make a difference. And you went to school in the first place with that aim in mind. And there's also not enough information about what those consequences are up front. If the ombudsman or the educational efforts could address that as well. I know for me, I've heard about garnishment of wages for federal student loans. So that is, there's no way out of that. I mean, how do you get around garnishment of your wages and a $700 monthly loan cycle?
I promise to look at the clock for you. It's
yes.
12:40. You got to,
yes.
Cause you got work to do.
I can be here another 5 minutes.
Okay. Bianca, I want to hear from you on this one here, especially when it comes to the possible impact of losing licenses and more. What do you think about this proposal?
I'm very in favor of his proposal, because in social work, especially, getting different professional licenses is really how you can end up making more money in the social work field, which is going to help you pay off your student loans. And like I said earlier, I've been in social work for so long that I'm not qualified in other fields. So if I made it so far and got my various licenses and then I had that taken away because of my loans, I would have to most likely go to a minimum wage job or something much lower than what I'm making now. And I really wouldn't have a shot of making my minimum payments right now. Like, that's hard for me right now. And I have my master's degree, but you need to have various licenses. And if you're going to take those away from people, some people can't even work in their field until they have their license. So it's good that they're going to have this protection in, because I know with social work, with mental health counseling, with like even nursing degrees, they have to pass their NCLEX. So people need to have these licenses in place so that they are able to work in the field that they spent all this money on.
Go ahead, Charlie.
And one more thing, Evan, this is thinking outside of the box a lot, but a lot, especially for our charter school students that we are working with, that are dealing with a lot of emotional trauma, I think that it's important for them to be involved in the arts a lot, and for them to be able to have jobs where they can be maybe even self-employed. And this totally marginalized the opportunity for those who are very authentically trying to come out with an artistic endeavor, artistic career, because we're channeling you into college, which is okay, and for you to get a job working for somebody else. But what about entrepreneurs? What about those who are looking for creative outlets and maybe wanting to make full-time jobs out of that? That is totally dismissing their opportunity to understand financially how they can save money and what they can do to build their own business. And I know a lot of students who need that outlet and need that opportunity just as much as being able to have another career. And they could have both, but they need to understand how the money works to be able to do that.
Let me get one more email, and then we'll get our break and a little bit of pushback. Aaron writes to the program and says, thanks for covering this important topic today. I'm 36 years old, and I do not understand millennials. I think you might be a millennial at 36. It's close. Anyway.
You are.
Aaron says, when I was 16, my parents pushed me to get my first credit card with a very small credit limit in order to learn the basics of paying it off each month with my after-school job earnings. It also taught me in a low-stakes environment about interest accrual if I carried a balance. I took student loans to afford my Cornell degree, and it took about 13 years to pay them off. Parents need to teach children these principles before they go to college, not after, and we can't rely on high schools to get that message across. That's from Aaron. Chuck Wade, what do you think?
Aaron makes a great point. You know, it's not just on the schools. The responsibility doesn't fall just on any one group. I think Aaron's really lucky to have parents who gave him an education of his own that it sounds like really benefited him. But it's an absolutely correct point. Some of the responsibility falls on parents, but at the same time, what if you have a kid who's coming from a household where they don't get that? That it's not the fault of a child what they do or don't get from a parent.
Or in my case, my parents were immigrants who came to this country.
Sure.
So they're trying to learn the language. They're trying to assimilate to a totally new culture. Mm-hmm. They're among highly educated group in America. They're both U.S. citizens now. But even they didn't have the financial education. So just, I would say you are so lucky to have the parents that you have. So many of us don't have that.
Okay. And some thoughts on that, Bianca?
I agree with both of Shadi and Chuck. And I mean, what about kids that are in group homes or in foster care, not in a stable foster home where they're going from home to home? They're not going to be able to get that sort of education from parental units or guardians because they don't have that in their lives. It's great if a parent can do that. And if someone does have the means to provide that to a child, they absolutely should. But it doesn't just fall on the parents. You know, there has to be other resources in place for children.
I think maybe we can take at least this from Aaron's email. Most of the people listening now would have the means to at least educate their own kids about this, and we should all try to be doing that.
It's a huge responsibility as a parent. Yes.
Let's get our only break of the hour and come back to more of your comments next as we talk loan debt on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, it's the State of the State Address. Governor Andrew Cuomo, with his annual State of the State Address, we'll talk about loan debt, yes. He will also talk about New York State's plan to deal with sexual harassment at the government level. And he will talk about many other issues, taxes, school spending, and more. Governor Cuomo live with the State of the State next hour. Hi, welcome back to Connections. Our guests in studio discussing the governor's proposal regarding student loan debt. You'll hear more next hour in the State of the State. We have Bianca Bishop, a healthcare integrator at Hillside Family of Agencies, talking about her own experiences dealing with student loan debt. Chuck Wade as well, and he's the vice president and financial advisor at Brighton Securities. Sherry, on the phone, I'm coming to you in a second. Let me just read this as a Food for thought here from Maria, and I appreciate this email. She says, Evan, I'm tuning in late to the show, but I wanted to encourage your panel and your listeners about the implementation of financial literacy at a young age. It sounds like your panel aligns with the mission of the Junior Achievements Pillars for eliminating poverty through financial literacy beginning in the elementary schools. In order to make this happen, we not only need volunteers going to the schools, but schools willing to bring junior achievement in. I hadn't heard about that, Maria. Email me separately about that. I'd like to learn more, but to the extent that schools might need volunteers for that, interesting. And we'll try to learn more about that and let our listeners know in the future. Because I think everybody agrees that more education on this subject is important. Let me get back to the phones, and this is Sherry. Go ahead, Sherry.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I just wondered what they're going to do for parents that were had to take out Parent Plus loans for their kids. I had three kids in college all at the same time, plus myself back in the 90s, and they went to banks to try to get loans back in that day, and there were no loans. They had no collateral. They had no jobs. They had nothing. So we were forced to take out Parent Plus loans, and there was no limit. We just kept taking them out. We'd say, well, you know, when are you going to tell me there's too much? And they said, never. And so we put three kids through college, plus myself, and I went to a master's program, and we're still paying on Parent Plus loans. And it's great that they're doing stuff for, you know, the students, but what about the parents? There's nothing. We've been paying on these loans for 25 years, and we're still paying.
Sherry, thanks for the phone call. Chuck Wade, we want to address that?
Yeah, I think the first thing, would be to have some sort of cap. I mean, that just seems, you know, really something that could be detrimental. I'm not entirely familiar with Parent Plus loans because they don't seem to come up as much as they used to. But at the same time, for there not to be some sort of cap or restriction to make it harder to get one of these after you've already got an outstanding balance just seems ludicrous.
So does that, again, these are very subjective words, and I want to be careful. But does that start to border on predatory to you if you don't have a cap and you continue?
Yeah, sure it can. I mean, it's okay. You know, one of the big issues that came up with the mortgage crisis in 2008 was how easy it was to get a loan. I think that there's some of that here just because it's so easy to get a student loan that we set ourselves up for a lot of problems, you know, and it could certainly border on predatory in certain cases, depending on the interest and how easy people are making it to have money lent to you, because at some point it comes time to pay up, and it can get pretty ugly then.
Yeah, Bianca, I'm just thinking of students or their parents in positions where they don't have the financial literacy, and if someone keeps making money available, a lot of people are going to say yes, right?
Absolutely, and it's a similar idea to those refund checks we were talking about earlier. If people see, oh, I have money, they aren't seeing that as a loan. They're seeing it as money they can use. You're not seeing the future of, oh, I need to pay this back. Now you're saying, oh, I have money right now, and I can use that right now because I have to survive right now.
It feels like free money to some people. I take that point. Back to Twitter, and Joe on Twitter says the following. He says, why not have a debt jubilee and forgive all student loan debt? Worth asking why this is such a radical idea, given all the other things we spend money on as a society. Instead, we penalize the young and the poor. I think this was a proposal among Jill Stein. It was a Jill Stein proposal, the Green Party candidate for president. You'll see that come up in various places. I don't know, Chuck, if you're ever going to see that in this country without at least some kind of a means testing.
I mean, here's the thing. Anytime something is forgiven,
I'm not endorsing or opposing.
No,
I'm just
understand.
Sort of observing kind of the dynamics.
Anytime that money is being or spending or taxation or any kind of liability is being reduced, it has to get made up somewhere. And that's what I wonder, all right, we're going to forgive. It's $1.48 billion, almost
trillion.
Almost $1.5 trillion.
It's almost $1.5 now?
Dollars.
That's great.
Worth of debt,
wow.
Which is the second largest outstanding liability in the country behind mortgages. Where is that going to be made up? Now, a certain chunk of that's coming from the federal government. So how do they make that up? They're going to have to cut expenditures somewhere else. Do they raise taxes? I don't have the answer, but it's not logical. It's not entirely logical to state, well, let's just forgive it all, because where are we getting that money from then?
Yeah, Joe, send me a separate message on, you know, just direct me more to what you think would be sort of the dominoes, because I suspect Joe would be willing to argue that loan debt is such a burden that it inhibits economic growth, creativity, enterprise, et cetera. And there's probably a lot to that. I mean, there's a lot for me to sort of crunch with that, and that may be its own separate conversation, but I appreciate that, Joe. Thank you for that. I'm going to grab another phone call. This is William in Rochester. William, got to keep it tight. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, yes. I heard some of the conversation, and I'm still surprised to hear people so quick to want to have the government intervene in the market prices of not only borrowing money, but in the concept that you would have a free-for-all when it comes to education. Certainly, if you wanted to have a socialized education system, you could just give it all away for free or have some sort of free-for-all on borrowing. But the way you make value, what affixes value to education is not only that you're giving someone a quality education, but also that you're preventing certain people from getting it. In fact, if we all had master's degrees, it liquidates the value of a master's degree or a PhD. So, you know, certainly I have plenty of student loans, and I haven't necessarily gotten the best value out of my education in a sense that I'm so doctor now and I'm working somewhere in the high hierarchy of society. But I think the important thing is that it was a risk that I had to take, and it was pushed on us. But that's marketing. And one of the classes that you take as an elective is marketing. So the idea that we could go ahead and, you know, make our own chance and take a risk and borrow that money, especially when it's guaranteed by the government, you know, there's no loss on my end. Certainly, if I don't make it, the loans are ultimately being dissolved through various programs that give special breaks to public servants and people who can't afford to pay them back and so on. So I would think that the idea to bring the price down on education is to stop subsidizing it. Anything with subsidy is going to be more expensive.
Yeah, William, thanks for the phone call. So there's a vote in favor of the value of risk and a vote in the favor of the value of saying a master's degree has a special value, that it does give someone an advantage, and that there should be a risk or some work involved in getting it. And anytime you take out a loan, there's risk involved. I mean, that's not untrue. Nothing he's saying there is
No, it's not at all. And I think some of that's a different conversation because, you know, how much the idea of a college education is pushed on us here in the United States. And we're all college graduates here, and I got a lot of value out of that. But there's a lot of professions now that you could go into with a trade, leave with no student loan debt, and be making $70,000, $80,000 a year without any debt. And that's an entirely different ball. I have clients who've done that and have set themselves up very well for their retirements because they didn't go to college. They went and worked and hadn't incurred all that debt. I think it's an entirely different topic of, you know, how much the value of education is pushed in certain scenarios on people here in our country.
Yeah, the value of education is pushed in a system that does lead to really, really heavy loan debt that can be really constraining. So I think what I'm hearing from Joe, people like Joe on Twitter, versus what you just heard from William is, if you do value education like this and you think it's a social good, treat it that way. Whereas William thinks that risk has a benefit to society. What do you think, Bianca?
I am agreeing with Chuck. I think it is a separate conversation. I do agree that different degrees are going to have different value and different risk, especially for different career fields. But I don't always think that there are the best options. Like in Rochester, for example, getting my master's degree, I went to Roberts Westland to get my master's degree because even though it's a private school, it was my cheapest option in this area. So I didn't have really an affordable option to get my master's degree that I needed to work in the social work field. So I do feel like, you know, you have to realize that there is a risk involved, but I don't think we're always given the options we should have.
All right. So Steven on Twitter says, I love the consternation over a $1.5 trillion loan giveaway. Didn't we just give $1.5 trillion to corporations and the wealthiest Americans? I take that point, Steven, and others are making that point. And Magnus says, it's taken me decades to get out from debt. Now that I'm sincerely changing the game plan and focusing on my own creative endeavors and ways to improve the city. Literally, without the debt, I am able to focus on making a difference to my Rochester community. In other words, now that he has got that out from under him, he can do other things. He can contribute in different ways. So a lot of conversation about what's going to happen. And again, listeners, next hour with the governor's state of the state, you're going to hear him address loan debt and what they think that they can do for it. Chuck, some final thoughts from you that you want to leave with our listeners on this issue?
Yeah, the one thing I would leave is if you've got student loan debt, look at refinancing it. And I'm just saying that because I did it myself and did it recently after having paid on my loans for over a decade.
You make it sound pretty easy. Is it easy?
It was not as difficult as I thought it would be, and I don't want to say that to say, oh, go do this. It's going to be really easy, and you'll get nothing but benefit from it. But, you know, I went, I looked at the numbers. They were very clear that by doing it, you know, I should have my loans done, you know, by 2020 instead of late 2021, which for me was a tangible benefit, and I was able to see the value that I would not have to pay in interest. And it's something I talk about with clients all the time: is if you've got significant debt, have you looked at refinancing it lately?
Okay, Bianca, some final thoughts.
If you are a college student or a parent of someone who's going to be going into college, make sure you have that financial education. Make sure you know what an interest rate is. If you're in college right now, go check out your student loans. You don't have to wait until you're graduated to look at that and where you are at the moment.
All right. Great stuff. And I think we can all walk away knowing that if you're in a position of privilege, like people like me, like I certainly am, I'm going to work to make sure that if my son goes on to higher education, he's going to understand exactly what that means if there are loans. The more knowledge, the better, and we're all going to work toward that. But let's listen to what the governor has to say next hour. Our thanks to Bianca Bishop, and good luck to you. Thanks for sharing your story this
Thank
hour.
Thank you for having me.
Chuck Wade from Brighton Securities, we'll see you over there and back here, I'm sure, sometime.
Thanks My pleasure.
For being here.
Thanks.
You never quite lose the broadcasting.
No, it's still fun to do it.
No, very good. Very good. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. State of the State next, and we'll talk to you Thursday on member-supported public radio.